Good evening. There we go. It's a bit of a delay. And are we on the monitor there? Okay. All righty. I do want to be on my headphone. So this is Art Chippendale live on Voice of Vashon, 101.9 LPFN. And my guest tonight on Songwriters Live is Michael Monteleone, a well-known drummer here on the island who's played with several bands. And he's going to talk a little bit about his history. And we both shared a history in the 60s in Claremont, California, where we had a folk music revival and launched a number of not only folk musicians, but rock musicians as well. So let me turn this over to you, Michael. Yeah, you just need to speak into the microphone there.
I can't hear myself, but can you hear me?
I can hear you faintly.
Faintly. 1, 2, 1, 2. Testing 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2.
Well, that should be good.
Yeah, that's a little better, yeah. Okay.
All right. So, Michael, how long have you been here on Vashon, and what's been keeping you busy?
I came in 1993. I had a business, a computer business, in downtown Seattle in Pioneer Square called Handy Mac, and it was a temporary personnel agency for mostly Macintosh people. But we eventually expanded to, you know, include the PC, the dark side of computers. So. And I was, you know, I was with people all day long, and I just thought it'd be really nice to come home to a really quiet place. And I only knew one person out here, my sister. And so I moved out here and bought a little farmhouse on Bank Road. And then continued the computer business for about a year, and then I sold it, and then I started doing databases for various and sundry people.
Mm-hmm.
I think including Puget Power and some, you know, things like that. And then a couple years, about 1996, I got really interested in this fellow named Lord Buckley, who was a nightclub comedian. And so without really knowing what I was doing, I decided to make a film about him. So I spent the next 15 years doing that mostly. And then about six or seven years ago, a friend of mine asked me if I had any interest in playing the drums again, which I hadn't played in 30 or 35 years. So I said, well, if you can put up with me, you know, with my non-existent, I mean, there was no connection between my brains and my fingers anymore, so it took a couple months for me to sound like a drummer again. So, and since then, I've just been playing in various and sundry bands. You know. Mostly a band called Harmalade, which was a band with Rebecca Kuzma, who I think most of us know that she had a really sad ending. And you know, that was, Rebecca dying was like a little tsunami that ran through the community because she played with a number of bands.
Yeah, and that was very sad.
She brought a lot of heart and soul to her efforts. So.
Right.
Yeah.
So I know you started out in Claremont playing with bands, and you and I actually knew each other. We'd met, there was a place underneath, I think it was the Presbyterian Church.
Oh, yeah. Agape.
Agape.
It was, yeah. I think it was a Methodist church. Was it the?
Okay.
Or congregational? Some form of Christianity.
Yes.
Liberal Christianity. Yeah, on Wednesday and Friday nights, the way I remember it, that they just kind of turned these areas of the church over to essentially teenagers, I think. And you could smoke cigarettes, you could drink coffee. But, you know, a lot of these kids were, their parents were teaching at the Claremont colleges. You know, in Claremont there were 5 colleges, a graduate school, and a school of theology. So there were a lot of, I mean, these kids, you know, you walk into this place, it was kind of like a giant coffee shop. And you see you see these kids playing chess and, you know, I mean, 2 16-year-olds, unlikely as it is, they were discussing Kierkegaard, you know. Anyway, I found about Agape because somebody asked us to come play there. I was in a band, and so we played there, and that was the night. I had been living in Ontario, which is 5 miles from Claremont, and is really it's not really known for anything other than the International Speedway, you know, and the airport. So. You know, Ontario has strip malls and a bunch of old churches and a dilapidated downtown. Anyway, discovering Claremont was, it was almost like getting religion, you know. And making the scene in Claremont a lot. You know, other musicians, there were bands like The Farm, wasn't that a band? Frank Record's band.
Oh, I remember Frank Record. Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. And blah, 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 blah. So.
Yeah, Frank used to play at our high school, you know, I can't remember the name of the band, but it was an allusion to a very lewd, a lewd commentary.
Was it clever?
It was clever. Yeah.
I remember Frank Rickard was. He seemed like his IQ was, you know, in the 4 digits. I mean, he was really a smart guy.
Yeah.
And he went on to play with some big guys, I think.
He did. He did a lot of session work for a lot of big name musicians.
Yeah.
And there were some other people back in that, you know, the same band, or, you know, around those people who also went on. And so I think Claremont was a real incubator for a lot of musicians.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of, I mean, having 5 colleges, you know, they were always hiring various people to, you know, I mean, some, you know, a lot of talent from out of town would come through. I mean, I remember there's a big auditorium there called Bridges Auditorium.
Right.
And I saw Van Cliburn there. And you know, I mean, it's not rock and roll, but he was pretty great.
I saw Frank Zappa there.
Oh, there you go. There you go. Yeah. His comrade in arms.
Right.
And all lots of, you know, Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee, I remember them coming. And,
right. Ellen, we had the Folk Music Store.
Yeah, right.
There. Uh-huh. And run by
Charles
Don
and
Chase.
Charles and Dorothy and Chase.
Wife, Charles and Dorothy Chase.
Right.
Yeah.
And now their daughter, Ellen, I think.
And Ellen, who later married Ben Harper.
Yeah. Oh, did she marry Ben Harper?
Oh. But actually, he grew up in Pomona. I think he went to college at Pitzer.
Oh, huh.
And that was one of the colleges. But they were mainstays there in Claremont. They even had a club called the or the Golden Ring.
Oh. You mean like a folk club?
It was a folk club.
Oh.
And we'd get folk musicians in there like every weekend. And, you know, they'd come down to Southern California, you know, sort of part of a tour. And Claremont, in part because of the Chases, it became a center, a magnet for folk musically and as well as later for rock and roll. They had, I remember seeing Linda Ronstadt there, and I'm not sure when Chris Darrow and they kind of hooked up in terms of as a musically, but they played together quite a bit.
Mm.
And Chris Darrow was also a real draw. David Linley.
Yeah, David Linley. And I don't remember, Chris was in a kind of a really cool group called Kaleidoscope.
Oh, yeah.
that they all were multi-instrumentalists, and they seemed to have pretty deep knowledge of folk music in a number of forms. It would probably been interesting to sit in on just a conversation with those people.
Right. So you were in a band called The South.
The South, yeah. The very first band I was in was called The Warlocks. And in 1963, when I was 13, but I looked like a 10-year-old. And it was a surf band. So, and the reason I got in the band was because I was over at my next door neighbor's one day, and he played guitar with, they were just forming this band. And he told me that if I could get a drum set, that I could be the drummer. So I talked my mother into buying me a drum set but I had to promise her that I would learn how to type. That was the price of the drum set, was I would learn how to type. And I said, well, why would I want, why typing? She goes, because you'll never be without a job. And she was right. She was absolutely right. If there was ever a time when I couldn't do, you know, I wasn't getting to do what I wanted to do and I needed money, I could always go to a temp agency and say, hey, I type X amount of words for a minute, you know. And
right.
It always, to this day, I suppose.
And to write, which you did a lot of.
What's that?
Writing.
Yeah. You mean back then?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You wrote. You wrote some music.
Yeah, I didn't really do that for quite a while though. I was, you know, I played drums, and I would write lyrics because I enjoyed language, but I would hand the lyrics over to one of the guys in my band, and they never seemed to get made into songs. So, and I don't know if that was more because they were lousy lyrics or because
they were illiterate.
Huh?
They were illiterate.
Well, maybe. The band called The South was, you know, there was a phenomenon back then called the garage band. And I don't know if in other states, in California, you know, everybody's got a garage. So it was the perfect place to put a bunch of noisy teenagers that either could or could not play very well. You'd put them out there and at least it'd be muffled a little bit, you know. And so we would play in these garages, you know, rotating from one group member to the next, like whose garage will it be next week? And,
right.
And you know, it was kind of like what they call woodshedding. You know, you practiced a lot more than you played out, performed out. But back then, back in the mid '60s, it was surprisingly a lot of little clubs to play in and stuff like that. You know, particularly if you were, if you didn't want money, you know, if they could get you for free, and we did that a lot, you know.
Of course.
Yeah. But those were good old days, you know. They seem kind of golden now. I'm sure I've forgotten the pain, you know, teenage angst and and you know, all the existential dilemmas that somebody has, whether they're conscious of them or not.
Well, you played for quite a while with the South and John Donaldson, who was
John Harrelson,
the lead singer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you have the song? Do you want to play the song?
I haven't quite queued that up yet, but.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, we can do that later. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, we played all over the place, and I don't know if this is. I find it remarkable. My mother was really supportive of me playing in a band, and you know, sometimes we would do a gig in the middle of the week, and I wouldn't get. And she would give me her station wagon, and I'd fill it full of drums and amplifiers, and we might drive off, you know, 40 or 50, 60 miles to play, like down to the beach or somewhere, and I wouldn't get home till midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning. And you know, this is when I was in high school, like maybe a junior in high school. And it was kind of phenomenal. And then everyone died.
Well, I heard Donaldson died not too long ago.
John Harrelson?
10 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah, I think he died in, 2012 maybe?
12 or 13.
Yeah, maybe 13. He's John was 3 months younger than me. This is he was kind of the de facto leader of the South. And yeah, he died, I think he was either 62 or 63 years old. But he struggled quite a while. What are you looking for?
Oh, I was looking to connect my phone here, and I can't find the cord. But
I have the songs on a CD, on an SD card, if that would help.
Oh, that would be great.
Okay. This was I don't remember the name of the recording studio. All I remember is the guy that recorded us, his name was Mike. He had the biggest head I've ever encountered in my whole life. And I don't mean ego, he just had an enormous
hat size.
Oh yeah, who knows what his hat size was. He was a very sweet guy. I think, sounds like someone moving furniture. What's
outside.
Oh. It says Arts Show, the folder. So, and it was just a little recording studio. We recorded two or three songs, and this is the only one that I think still exists. And in a past life, I was the king of Serbia. Hmm? Actually, no. I worked in the kitchen of the king's kitchen. Do you notice that whenever anybody talks about being reincarnated, they were always a prince or a wizard or a king or something. Nobody was a scullery maid. Nobody mucked out the stables. You know, they were.
I've mucked out stables here on Vashon. I didn't think I was living the dream. What happens when you have a daughter with a horse?
Oh. Did you figure it out?
I'm looking for a slot here on the computer that would take this.
Maybe on the back of it? Or that's just a monitor, huh?
Gosh, well, I'm sorry.
Okay.
See if I can figure that out in a minute.
Okay.
So, you
after Claremont, you met some people in Hollywood. And I don't know, I know you said that you did a movie. You did a movie.
Oh, that was 20
years. Dead Man Rockin'.
Oh.
And I'm wondering, is that how you met people like Robert Redford? And
No, that I worked on a movie in the mid 80s, 1986, I think. I was, at that time, I was writing electronic music for performance artists and dance companies, and I did some small little, like, soundtracks for films and things, scores for films, and these people had, they were making a movie called Legal Eagles, which Robert Redford and Deborah Winger and Daryl Hannah, and Daryl Hannah plays a performance artist in that film, and she told me that she tries to seduce Robert Redford, and she does it by doing this performance art stuff that she does, which involves a lot of fire and innuendo, I suppose. Anyway, let's see where. Anyway, they hired, when they got back to, it was done at Universal Studios, when they got back to Los Angeles, the filming that they had done of this performance scene, they said, was just dreadful. So they decided to hire a real performance artist. So they hired a friend of mine, Lynn Hickson, and then she called me and said, do you want to do the music? So, which was really nice, because I had about $40 to my name when she called, you know. And anyway, so yeah, but that was 20 years later. I had a couple stints in Hollywood when I was in college. A friend of mine worked in Los Angeles for a production company, and whenever they would come to San Francisco, where I was going to school, they would call and say, "Do you want to work for a couple of days?" So I just would, you know, do. I was a gopher. You go for this, you go for that.
Yeah.
So. I remember one time, so exciting. I drove to the airport and picked up 300 pounds of hot dogs and hams for an Oscar Mayer commercial. It was a huge. I couldn't get it in the car. I had to break up the box and to get it in the car. So.
I'd like to hear a song about that.
Yeah. What would you call it?
Meat.
Yeah, meat. Anyway, I did that in college, and then later on, it was 1986, I got hired to do that music. And then that led to, one thing led to another, and I did a little bit of work on an MTV show called The Cutting Edge, where I did what they call bumpers, or, you know, like when you're coming in and out of a commercial, or you're going from one segment to the other, there's these little odd pieces of music.
Yeah.
I think this is germane. When I was 18, I was playing in a band called Hard Luck Boy.
Right.
And we were kind of based in Ontario, but, you know, Claremont was still the thing. It was so much more interesting there. We practiced. It was a group with four really strong musicians, and we practiced for 6 months without even trying to get a gig. But like three or four nights a week we would practice, and finally one night we were starting to set up in somebody's garage, and somebody in the band said, "I'm really tired of rehearsing. Can we go find an audience?" So we packed up the cars with our gear, and we drove to Claremont, the 5 miles to Claremont, and we just cruised around the colleges, and we found there was at Pomona College, it has a beautiful old ballroom, and a kind of an Art Deco ballroom, and there was a band playing there, and a pretty big crowd, and people were dancing, And somebody said, ah, too bad that, you know, there's somebody playing there. And somebody else said, well, why can't we just set up at the other end of the ballroom? So, that's what we did. We pulled the cars into the dock, loading dock. Somebody went inside and opened the doors, and we just loaded the equipment in, and we set it up at the opposite end. You know, the other band was still playing, so we were just about set up. You know, we were testing the mics and tuning the guitars, and these kids with clipboards came running through the crowd because a crowd started to form in front of us, and they said, what are you doing? What are you doing? And we said, well, we've come to play. Well, I don't know anything about you playing. You're not on the clipboards here. Well, I said, well, yeah. Somebody called us from Pomona and said, come and play. Well, they said, well, who's that? Well, we said, Dr. Johnson. A lot of doctors around the Claremont colleges. So, and the guy didn't know who Dr. Johnson was, but it's conceivable you wouldn't know everybody on the faculty, right? So then he goes, well, I don't know that this is really, I don't know if we can do this, you know. And then somebody in our band who, it was an exercise in being cheeky, really. And the person in the band said, look it, man, we drove all the way from San Diego. That's 200 miles. We came to play tonight, you know. I mean, we'd really only come 5 miles. But so the guy kind of shrugged his shoulders. He kind of gave up, you know, and said, okay, all right, well, you know. So we did a set. And we went over really big, and then the other band did another set, and then we did a second set, and then we convinced them to pay us. We've got $150.
Oh, great!
And that was our very first gig, that Hard Luck Boy, and then Hard Luck Boy went on through a series of things. Somebody saw us play somewhere and invited us to play somewhere else, and somebody there saw us. And hooked us up with a guy who was promoting concerts.
So yeah, wasn't that at USC? Was that a gig at USC?
No, it was at UC San Diego.
Oh.
Yeah. We played, what happened is that was 1968. That was 68 or 69? 68. And that was when the Berkeley riots were happening and the protests spread to the others in the university system. The other colleges, and so we were. One of our guys, the guys in our band, was going to school at UC San Diego, so we would go down there to rehearse. And then when the riots or the protests happened, we started playing for the protests. You know, we'd be the protest band. And then after the protests died down, the people that had hired us became the student government. So they hired us. We did one gig with the Flaming Groovies, which was a group from San Francisco, pretty really good group. But they weren't all that famous. But and then that led to us playing with a gig with the Quicksilver Messenger Service, and they were pretty big at the time.
Yeah.
And then it was going to be the Quicksilver Messenger Service, and then Hard Luck Boy, but some friends of theirs showed up. These people called the Sons of Champlin, and they were like, it was like if Woodstock met Stax Records. I mean, they were stone cold hippie looking guys, but they played R&B like they were from Stax Records. And they were just phenomenal. So and then somebody saw us there, and then they hooked us up with this manager, so we started playing a lot of. We would open for a lot of big gigs, but a lot of big acts. And on the bill, you know, on the bill, we would be called Plus More or And Others. Anyway, but we played with the Animals, Jefferson Airplane, Janis Joplin, Canned Heat, Chicago, It's a Beautiful Day, Paul Butterfield, Procol Harum, playing Burrito Brothers, and we played one time with Led Zeppelin, which was on
That's
their
quite
very
a roster,
huh?
That's quite a roster.
Yeah, and it was, you know, it would be, you know, 5,000, 10,000 people, I think the most was we played at a pop festival, and the most they say there were maybe 45,000 people there. So that's the biggest crowd I've ever been in front of. But that's It's strangely enough, it's easier to be in front of that many people than it is 12 people in a little club. Because in a little club, everybody can see your face. Everybody, you know, you're dealing with human beings. When you've got 45,000 people, it's just this massive thing. Just almost faceless.
And then you took a long break.
Yeah, I was in a mental hospital for I was in one more band. Hard Luck Boy broke up, and then I was in one more band called Rockabye, and for about a year and a half, and then. You know, I went to college and graduate school and struck out into the world to do other things. And I studied acting and directing in college and lived in New York for 10 months trying to become Laurence Olivier, you know. And that was actually the best thing that could have happened, is that I actually went to New York and not thought about it. You know, like it's... If you think back on those things that you didn't do, those are the things you go, now, what would have happened if I did, if I had, you know, done that? And I went and did it and realized that I was, you know, I think I had some natural talent as an actor, but I didn't have the kind of absurd amount of self-regard. And I wasn't driven. I wasn't driven to... I don't know what you would call it. I was, I didn't have whatever it took. You know, you need three things. You need some talent, you need some luck, and you need drive. And I had one and a half of those.
So you came back to Vashon, or you came to Vashon?
Well, I moved down. I was making my way back to California, and there was this theater troupe in New Orleans that was going to do one of my plays. So I thought, I'll mosey on down there, and they were going to pay me some. So I'll mosey on down there and visit friends there, and then they'll pay me, and then I'll head to California. And when I got there, they decided not to do the play. So, and I didn't have enough money to get to California, so I... Somebody suggested I wait tables. So I learned how to wait tables, and I worked in this little Italian restaurant called Turchi's. And it was a great place. I was there for five months. And I was almost feel like I was genetically born to wait tables, you know, like I was coding. I loved every minute of it. Little Italian place run by a one-armed woman named Miss Rose. Miss Rose Turchi, the daughter of the original owners. And it was a little restaurant full of characters. So I worked there full time, and then I drove around Louisiana and skulked around these great old cemeteries in New Orleans. And then came back to California and blah, 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 blah.
Well, so that what brought you up here?
I was working in San Francisco for a temp agency doing, well, here's where the typing comes in. It was the early years of, it would have been 1989. It was the fairly early years with the personal computer, and I was facile with computers. So I was working for a temp agency called Mac Temps, Macintosh people. And I happened to come up I came to Seattle to go to a wedding, and I had been toying with the idea of maybe opening my own temp agency. So while I was up here for the wedding, I went to these temp agencies, Manpower, Kelly Girl, you know, whatever else there was, and I filled out their applications, and you know, they always say, well, what skills do you have? And I said, well, I can do Macintosh. I can do Microsoft Word, I can do Excel, I can do PageMaker, blah blah blah. And all four of these places I went to, when they would do the sit down interview with me, they said, "Well, it's very nice that you have these skills, but we don't really get very much call for this." And I remember thinking, they have no idea what's coming. That, you know, it was 1989, and it was just all about to burst onto the scene. So I went back to San Francisco and decided when I could, I was going to move up here. And so I moved up to Seattle, and I started a little company called Handy Mac. Oh. And I did that for 4 years. And the audience can't see this, but a friend of mine is right here who I met through Handy Mac. And it was, if nothing else, that was a great reason to have our business.
And so you came to Vashon then?
I came to Vashon. My sister, Patricia Tuvey, lives out here. And a lot of people know her. And
yeah.
And I was interviewing people all day and doing, you know, computer, and on the phone all day, you know, setting up jobs for people. And I just wanted somewhere quiet where I didn't know anybody. So I came out here and bought a house. Yeah.
It's an easy place to be if you don't want to know anybody.
Well, for about 6 years, you know, for 6 years, it was kind of exactly what I had wanted, which is, I didn't know anybody, and I was, you know, recouping from really, I was kind of got fried, you know, burnt out doing the business. And so, but after about 6 years, I thought, well, I'm not being social, and didn't seem like it was going to happen. So I thought, well, maybe I'll think of the next place to go live. And then all of a sudden, I mean, it was almost like a little mystical thing. All of a sudden, people started going, inviting me to dinner, or hey, do you want to do this? Do you want to do that? And all of a sudden, I had a little social scene, and that led to people saying, what do you do? And da da da. And one thing led to another, and I started working on this film about this nightclub comedian named Lord Buckley. And I got into video quite a bit, filming and editing. And sorry, I shouldn't have eaten what I ate for dinner.
So when did you pick up the sticks again?
That was, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago. This guy, Tony Mann, who's a keyboard guy in the island, we were talking one day, and he was putting a band together, and he just said, you want to play the drums? And I said, well, you know, I haven't for so long. I mean, and it was true, you know, when you play a lot, there's some kind of, the nerves that go from your brain down to the ends of your fingers, there's a well-defined path, you know. And if you don't use it, you lose it, you know. So the whatever neural pathway from my brain to my fingertips was atrophied to the point where it was, you know, I might as well have had a stroke, you know, for how much control I had over the sticks. So I sat in my room and I tick 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 tick, tick with the sticks until I could get to the point where I could go to a rehearsal and not just waste everybody's time. And then over the years, it got easier and easier. And now I play with an electronic kit, which was a revelation. A Roland, I forget the name, you know, XYZ25645, you know, whatever it is. But it's I have 100 different drum sets at my fingertips. I can just dial in. You know, I can dial in something that sound like Led Zeppelin. I can dial in something that sound like a military band. I can dial in something that sound like, you know, a bunch of instruments on Bali. You know, I mean, whatever you want. Or you can put your own sounds in there. You know. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, so I usually play that. And then I play with a fellow named Carter Castle.
Yeah.
Who's a really wonderful singer-songwriter in the island, huh?
I had him on the show here.
Oh, you did?
like October, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Carter's, I think he's a marvelous songwriter. And he's a really good egg, you know. I mean, I have breakfast with him every Monday morning. Ah. And, you know, we've been doing this for 3 or 4 years now, and we've never run out of things to say or got bored with each other, you know.
I've had coffee with him a few times, and it's just...
Conversation
just keeps flowing.
Yeah, he's alive and curious about the world, and I think he's very wise. And his songs have, you know, a beautiful combination of sentiment and mystery, you know, enigma, dashes of old folk songs, and, you know, really, I really his writing is exquisite, I think. And then I play with one other band, which is it's the Don Marco Trio, mm-hmm. But it's a quartet, so. And it's three guys. Three other guys. And
yeah. Fun. Who else is in that?
Mark Hickling, he plays piano and sings. Don Lofstrom is a bass player. And then Mikey Naukas, who's kind of new to the island. Well, new, 6 years he's been on the island. He plays guitar.
All right.
Mikey also plays with Carter, so I play two bands with him.
It's almost incestuous here on the island. But you have so many musicians.
Incest is relative, I think.
Ah-ha-ha.
Incest is rolling your own?
Never thought of it that way. So...
Did you ever play in bands?
I did. I was not... I wasn't great. I played the guitar. Uh-huh. My father bought me a cheap Gibson electric when I was about 18. Uh-huh. And I used to, you know, learned a lot of chords. Well, I'll tell you what, I did actually learn guitar earlier than that. I bought my first guitar from Charles Chase at the Folk Music Center in Claremont. Uh-huh. And I took lessons from him and from his wife, Dorothy. And I also learned the banjo from, his last name's Marcotte.
Oh.
Bill or Will Marcotte.
Jerry? Was it Jerry Marcotte?
No, I didn't know.
I bet it's a brother or something.
Oh, maybe.
Jerry Marcotte is a...
Yeah. So I played in a few bands, and, you know, most of us were just hacks. And we wrote music and played it, and I think we went into a booth sometime and tried to record something. You know, it's just one mic for all of us. We're all crammed in there.
It was bigger than a little photo booth.
A little bit bigger than that. Maybe three times or four times the size, you know.
You can get a drum. You wouldn't put a drum set in there, would you?
Yeah, probably not. You know, you'd have to bring a maracas or something.
Yeah.
But, I didn't have the talent. I really didn't. I did enjoy writing songs.
You did enjoy what?
Writing songs.
Oh, writing songs?
Yeah.
Oh. Do you ever get to hear them played? I mean, did you perform them?
Never for more than friends and family, that sort of thing. I never had the, I felt like I didn't have the charisma or the ego to back it up.
Yeah, it's the same thing with acting, you know, you have to have talent, luck, and a little bit of drive, I think.
Mm-hmm. I was more of a shy guy when I was a teenager. Mm. Young.
I was fairly shy too, but we had people in the band who were pushy. you know, they would push us. I mean, I was I don't know back then if I could have been a guitarist or a singer, because it was kind of too naked, it was just you. Mm-hmm. Like a singer, it's just you and the microphone and 8,000 people. I was behind a wall of all these drums and cymbals.
Right. Yeah.
And I had long enough hair I could just hide my face if I wanted to.
So, what were your favorite influences?
Well, two drummers that I would cite as the real major influences. Mm-hmm. One was Ringo Starr, mm-hmm. who I don't think is technically a very good drummer. I mean, he's a left-handed drummer who plays on a right-handed kit, but I thought with the Beatles, he did exactly what they needed. I mean, mm-hmm. if you didn't have Ringo there, you could recognize it as a Beatles song, but it wouldn't have that one. It would be that element that was missing. Mm-hmm. And the other drummer that I just loved him was a jazz drummer named Joe Morello, who was the drummer for Dave Brubeck Quartet.
Mm-hmm.
And they came to my high school when I was 16, and wow. I got to hand out programs at the in the lobby when people were coming in, and then they let me stay for the concert. And that guy, he's gone now, but he was so skilled. He could do, there's some video of him. A drum roll is where one stick, you hit one stick on the drum, then the other one in rapid succession. So you can hardly, it becomes, yeah. Well, he could do that, but he could do it with one hand. I mean, he could just take one hand and make it sound like there were about four people playing the drums at once.
Wow.
And then he just had, Dave Brubeck Quartet, they toyed. They didn't toy with it. They were masterful at time signatures.
At time signatures,
yeah, 7/8, 5/4, 3/4 time.
Yeah.
Not just okay, you can count it, but they would go into other little universes when they played. And Joe Morello, he has this one drum solo he does in a song called "Far More Drums," which is a song in 5/4. So it goes 1/2/3, 1/2, 1/2/3, 1/2, 1/2/3. But he's playing, I don't know how he did it. And the whole, this is kind of geeky, nerdy stuff, but the whole time he's doing his solo, his hi-hat sound was just going, because a drummer is doing four different things at once. But I think he did about nine different things at once. And I met him. Backstage at that particular concert that I handed out the programs for, and he was I thought he was kind of infantile. It turned out he was legally blind because his wife was kind of leading him around, and I thought he hardly looked like he knew what he was doing, but I think it was because he was legally blind. Because as a technician, you could have probably thrown any kind of rudiment at him or any kind of difficult drum thing, he would have done it just fine. But then he had this gorgeous, gorgeous artistry. He had something within him that went far beyond. And when I would be around other rock and roll drummers or other rock and roll musicians, and I'd mention jazz, and particularly him, they would just scoff, they would just like dismiss it. And they really didn't know what they were missing. He was Saint Joe Morello.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, they were, they hit a lot of colleges, right, basically. Mm-hmm. I think they did that all around the country, all around the country.
Yeah. And, you know, they were three white guys and one black guy. And, you know, that, I mean, they got a little, Eugene Wright was their bass player. Mm-hmm. And they would, I know in the South they would get hassled about it. You know, but they were, all four of them were pretty phenomenal. They're all dead now, I think. Maybe Eugene Wright is still alive.
Oh.
But I was backstage. This is a little tale. I was backstage they came to my high school and we had a WPA theater. It was held 2,000 people. And I worked in the theater department as, you know, when I was going to school there. And so at the intermission, I went backstage, and the first thing I did was go to the bathroom backstage. And I walked in the bathroom and started to pee, and I could smell somebody was smoking a joint, you know. I mean, I was 16. I knew what marijuana was.
Of course.
And then out of the toilet stall comes Paul Desmond, who was the sax player.
The sax player, yeah.
The one that was, you know, was responsible for that riff in Take Five, you know.
Right.
And he looked a little like, uh-oh, I got caught. And I just nodded and said, you know, hello. And he went on. But then knowing that he'd smoked a joint, when I was listening to the second half of the show, he was another phenomenal thing. I just, you know, I was such a lightweight. I mean, if I smoked a joint, I couldn't remember what song we were playing, you know.
And you know, there are so many stories about those jazz musicians, you know, who seemed to live on a diet of drugs.
Mm.
You know, it didn't do a lot of them, you know, a lot of good in the end, but they sure played some amazing music.
You know, I know a story about Charlie Parker, the saxophone player, and he only lived to be, I don't know, 33 or something. I mean, and he drank and drank and drank, and who knows what else he was doing. But there's a story of during the last year of his life, he had gotten really out of shape, kind of really fat, and the story goes that he took all his clothes off and he was looking in a full length mirror, and he turned sideways and looked at himself and said, "Damn, I done worn this thing out."
Yeah. So, what have you got going forward? Are you playing any gigs?
There's a couple little gigs coming up. I just finished. Sorry, this is sort of braggy. I just finished. I helped Bruce Morser. Bruce Morser is an illustrator. Sorry, this is name dropping time. His clients are NASA, National Geographic, Starbucks, people like that. He's just a gorgeous illustrator. Anyway, he has a retrospective at Vashon Center for the Arts right now, and he asked me to help him put together this. He has a children's book called Memories of Castle Island, and so I helped him. Took these illustrations and kind of did a little sort of Ken Burns treatment on them, and it was one of the most beautiful things I've ever done. I should have paid him. It was so moving every time I worked on it for a couple of weeks, I don't know if they have a copy at the VCA right now, but even if they don't, the show is really worth seeing. He's kind of transcendent.
Yeah, those crossfades of Ken Burns and the way he moved, he made it seem like those the Civil War figures were moving,
yeah,
and then they would blend together and then move to another scene.
And it was so simple, you know? I mean, yeah, he moved, the images moved, and they got larger and smaller. But they did it in such a way that you didn't lose sight of what he was trying to illustrate.
Right.
You know, you didn't get, you didn't go, oh, that is great technique. You were, it was in service of, you know, the letter that somebody was reading, or one of the talking heads, you know, talking about the person that you, that the camera's going in and out of.
Sure.
Yeah.
It must be great to have so many different skills that you can rely on, you know.
It's fun, you know. I'm grateful for the time I've had to kind of explore these things, you know.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. And then, let's see what happens. In the fall, I it's really hard to believe, but I'm married to this woman named Pam Ingalls, who is...
gosh.
Who's about 3 feet taller than me. And anyway, she teaches a workshop in Italy. And, what'd you say?
With bright red hair.
Yeah, with bright red hair, right. And anyway, she teaches a workshop in Italy in September. So we'll be doing that. And then maybe heading over to up to Yorkshire, up in the north of England, to...
Now, last time you were there, was that earlier this year?
Mm-hmm.
Didn't you go visit Dylan Thomas's grave?
Oh, yeah, that was last year. Yeah, that was last fall. Yeah, we went to Wales. So, yeah, are you from up there, from Yorkshire? Is your family from up there?
My family is, it's northern Yorkshire, up in a little village called Chipping. Hence the Chippendale name.
Oh.
And I don't know that much more about it. Well, apparently that little village was given to some lord who had helped King Harold. Not King Harold. The Norman King.
Richard?
William.
Richard.
William.
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 Yeah, William. Exactly, William.
We actually have William a historian in residence.
So, yeah. William the Conqueror had, he gave out largesse and land and, to those people who helped him.
Oh.
Kind of like somebody we know right now who's And so he got this little village of Chipping. I'm thinking, well, he probably, what did he do for that? You know, little village. But then somewhere along the way, the Chippendales, one of our great, 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 great grandfathers, started to make furniture.
Oh.
Of course, he didn't pass anything down to us, but. It's just kind of fun to know.
Oh. So there is Chippendale furniture, isn't there?
There is.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Don't have a stick of it.
Oh.
Okay. Well, thank you for coming in, Michael, and illuminating, you know, what you've been up to, and, you know, and I'd love to see you play again. I don't know if you've got a gig coming up. Are you playing up at the Coop or something?
We do. I think June 6th, the Don Marco Trio, which is actually a quartet, is playing at the Apothecary.
All right.
I think that's the next gig.
Great.
Yeah.
So
thanks for having me.
This is Art Chippendale and my guest here, Michael Monteleone, signing off on Voice of Vashon, KVSH. 101.9 LPFM. Stay tuned next month when my guest will be Paul Caldwell.
Oh, that'll be good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.